What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
Why do Catholics worship Mary?
What's stopping you?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
Where is purgatory in the Bible?
What's stopping
you? I think the Pope has too much authority.
What's stopping you? You are called to communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Hey, everybody. Welcome again to Call to Communion here on EWTN. It's the program for our non-Catholic brothers and sisters. Hey, if that is you and you are a non-Catholic, you've got a question about the Catholic faith, you're in the right place at the right time. Here's our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. If you're listening to us today in Helsinki, Finland, you'll want to dial 1 and then 205-271-2985. And of course, you can always send us an email, which is the best way to contact the show if you're watching us on TV today. The address for that, ctc@ewtn.com. You can also text the letters EWTN to 58177. Wait for our response, then text us your first name and your brief question. Message and data rates may apply. All right, we are ready to roll here. Charles Beery is our producer. Matt Kabinski is our phone screener. And Ace McKay is handling social media, or I believe it's Rich Jesse today. If you have a question that you'd like to pose via YouTube or Facebook, we are streaming on both those platforms right now. Just put your question in the comments box, if you would. Rich will see that. He'll shoot it to us here in Studio One, and we are off to the races. I'm Tom Price, along with Dr. David Anders.
Tom, how are you?
Very well. How are you, sir?
I'm doing all right. Thank you.
Interesting question here from Maria. She says, my question is, in the Bible, we are told we cannot call a priest father because we only have one father in heaven. We do, however, call our priests father. Is this a literal term, or does it mean something else?
Yeah, thank you. I really appreciate the question. Well, the Bible says nothing of the sort. It does not say that you cannot call your priest father. What it does say is that you can't call anyone father.
Ah.
Something that the rest of the Bible manifestly is inconsistent with.
Okay.
Right? So we find biological fathers and revered religious figures being referred to as father throughout the Old and New Testament. Take a few celebrated examples. When Elijah is taken up to heaven, Elisha says, my father, the chariots and the horsemen of Israel. St. Paul says, I have become your father through the gospel to the Corinthians, and Timothy, my son. And Jesus refers to Father Abraham. And so clearly, the rest of the Bible didn't get the memo if Jesus said you're not allowed to call anybody father. And, of course, speaking in the third person, St. Paul talks to fathers. He says, you know, fathers, don't exasperate your children, and children, obey your fathers in the Lord, and so forth. And that, you know, your fatherhood is honorable, and all fatherhood is derived ultimately from the fatherhood of God. So to be called father is an honorable thing, and places you in relationship to the fatherhood of God. So there's clearly no total categorical prohibition on calling people father. In the same text, Matthew 23, Jesus says, don't call anybody rabbi. Then his own disciples turn around and call him rabbi, and they call him teacher in similar words, other synonyms. So we're not to take this as a categorical denunciation of ever using the word father in any context. And clearly, we call our own biological father's father, and
sure,
you know, rarely do people bat an eye about that. So what's really in view here? Well, it falls in a condemnation of the Pharisees specifically. Jesus is rebuking Pharisees who, at least the ones that he's dealing with in this text, have acceded to positions of religious authority because they are seeking to be honored by men. That's the motive. You know, he warns in another place, you know, don't say long prayers in the marketplace in public to be seen by men. When you pray in private, your Father who sees you in private will reward you. So it's really vaingloriousness that he is, vanity that he's condemning here. And those that would be flatterers. And so the application to the Catholic priesthood would be, and actually Jesus never talks about the Catholic priesthood here. Catholic priesthood is just totally not in view. But if you were going to apply this to the Catholic priesthood, I'd say if a young man presented himself at the vocations office for his diocese and the priest in charge or the bishop said, well, you know, so young man, why would you like to become a priest? And he says, well, golly jeepers, I just really want to hear people call me Father. And it just occurred to me that if I become pastor of the church, I get to call the shots, you know, and decide where the offering plate goes. And, I that's the kind of reason, that's what my motivation is, you know. Hey, priesthood, it's a great job. You work one day a week, play golf the rest of the time, you know. That's his conception. Yeah, and people call me Father for get all kind of honor out of the business. So that's my motive for becoming a priest. Good bishop would say, sorry, next candidate, please.
Yeah.
That's the wrong motivation. Yeah. Priest should enter into this because he wants to enter into a life of service. And actually, priesthood done right is not a one-day-a-week job. It's a 7-day-a-week job, and sometimes an all-night job, too, for that matter.
Yeah.
But that's really the application. Don't be vainglorious. Don't seek religious office or any other office, for that matter, out of self-aggrandizement. That's really what's in view.
Very good. And Maria, thanks so much for your question. Here's one now from Leslie, watching us on YouTube. Dr. Anders, why is it a precept of the Church that Catholics must receive the Eucharist at least once a year during Easter, when we already have a Sunday obligation? Wouldn't they be in mortal sin?
Okay, thanks. I appreciate the question. So a couple things. First of all, the Easter communion as an obligation of the Church is much older than the universal obligation to attend Mass on Sundays. The Sunday obligation actually entered into the Code of Canon Law universally for Latin Rite Catholics only in 1917.
Wow.
So, but whereas the precept to receive communion once a year dates from the Fourth Lateran Council in 1215. So they're conceptually distinct.
Mm-hmm.
Second of all, you're confusing attending Mass with receiving communion. And for quite a long time, for many centuries in the West, the practice for lay Catholics who attended Mass every Sunday was not to receive communion every Sunday, but in fact to receive very rarely, if ever.
Hmm.
And so the reason the Lateran Council insisted that Catholics commune at least once a year was to ensure that they would commune at least once a year.
Yeah.
And the form of the Mass has changed over the centuries. And when you go to Mass, you're really accustomed to lay communion being an integral part of the celebration. And that's the mind of the Church, that it should be so. Was not always the case. The principal benefit of the Mass, and this is still the case today and always has been the case, is not so much the communion but the sacrifice, the offering of Christ's body and blood. Now, in medieval spirituality, an awareness of the sacrifice of the Mass sometimes so overwhelmed every other aspect that communion was almost an afterthought for the laity.
Very good. And Leslie, thanks for watching us on YouTube today. We have open lines today on EWTN's Call to Commune. Wide open phones at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986 for Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders. Do stay with us. Hey, glad you're with us for Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders here on EWTN. Our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. This is a very good time to call, 833-288-3986. If you're watching us on TV today, well, you can participate as well. Shoot us an email. The address for that, ctc@ewtn.com. Here's a question from Kevin watching us on YouTube. I've been told by a priest that Mormons need to be able to understand precisely who Jesus Christ is. Can you explain this?
You're told by a priest that Mormons need to understand exactly who Jesus Christ is. Well, everybody should understand who Jesus Christ is, not just Mormons, right?
Yeah.
So I'm not sure what is intended by specifying Mormons, except that Mormons have a very different Christology from the Catholic Church. They have a very different view of God from the Catholic Church. And so in Catholic theology, God is the first principle, the metaphysical first principle of all of reality. So anything that exists exists because it derives ultimately from the will of God. God is literally where the buck stops. There's nothing prior to God in any respect, temporally, metaphysically, you name it. There is no explanatory principle higher than God, okay? And Jesus, in Catholic theology, is God in that fully robust metaphysical sense, God, capital G, full stop.
Okay.
Now, in Mormon theology, first of all, that's not how they define God. Mormon theology doesn't really postulate a first principle of reality. And if it did, God is not that. And the God that Mormons worship is understood to be a creature someone who at one time did not exist and came into existence and was elevated to the state of godhood. And so it's much more like the gods of Greek mythology or the heroes of Greek mythology who would be elevated to divinity through some process of apotheosis. And Jesus is a biological offspring of such a god, and not co-eternal or co-substantial with God, either in the ultimate sense or even in a subordinate way. He's a separate creature and a separate being who, among other things, happens to be brothers with Satan. And so that's a very, very different cosmology. It's a different way of thinking about the way the world is organized and the way reality is organized. And, of course, they have a very different doctrine of redemption as well, and what Jesus is thought to have done and accomplished, and how he reveals his will to mankind, and how people come into relationship to God, and what it means to be saved is very, very different in Mormonism than it is in all forms of classical Christianity, including Catholicism.
All right. And, Kevin, thanks so much for watching us on YouTube. If you're ready now, let's go to the phones at 833-288-EWTN, beginning today with Dean in Winchester, Massachusetts, listening on Sirius XM, channel 130. Hey there, Dean. What's on your mind today, sir?
Hey, good afternoon, Mr. Price, Dr. Anders. Thank you for taking my call. Long-time listener, multiple caller, and I really appreciate your show, how it's connected the dots for me personally to tie in the reasons and the historical truths behind our faith. And I didn't realize how actually superstitious to a degree I was. Changing gears a little bit, yeah, though, I do have a question, and the question is it sinful to, and I know we hate sin, but is it sinful or is it wrong to hate, you know, the fallen angels that tempt us or you know, like Satan, or is it wrong to actually hate?
I really appreciate the question. So let me give you some background and context on that. When you go to the Old Testament and you read God's covenant promises to Abraham, to Moses, to David, to the exilic and post-exilic prophets, one thing that you find consistently from the beginning to the end of the Old Testament is the promise that part of God's covenant commitments to his people is that he will deliver them from their enemies. And in the context of the Old Testament, that really seems to be human political enemies, those, you know, Ammonites and Philistines and Babylonians and Egyptians and those that literally oppressed the people of God. And the conquest, the victory in view, seems to be military and geographical. So God tells Abraham, your children will possess the cities of their enemies. He tells David, I will give you rest from all of your enemies. When you read the prophecies of Isaiah and then even, you know, later the exilic and post-exilic prophets, it's, you know, God's going to throw the horses of their enemies into confusion. He'll strike them with plagues. Israelite soldiers or Judean soldiers will possess what are tantamount to superpowers, and Jerusalem will triumph over the nations, and foreign kings will bring tribute, and gold and camels will flow in the streets of the holy city. And this kind of language is just everywhere in the Old Testament. You can't get away from it. And there's no tendency to spiritualize it. It's pretty concrete, immediate. You know, the Judeans are going to beat the heck out of their enemies. That's pretty much what's in view. But in Daniel, which is a very late text in the Old Testament, you get a wrinkle thrown in, and that's the idea that behind the enemies of God, the enemies of the people of Israel, behind those foreign armies, there are cosmic forces. And we read about the prince of Persia who opposes the people of God, who seems to be a kind of territorial spirit. And against them, God has assigned the archangel Michael, who will battle for the Lord's people in this cosmic realm. And so you still have political conflict, but you have added to that a kind of cosmic conflict at a second level. Then something fascinating happens in the Gospels. The language of conflict and warfare and conquest is still pervasive. And yet Jesus conspicuously says, when it comes to human enemies, love them and forgive them and pray for those that persecute you. And blessed are the peacemakers, for they'll be called children of God. And there just isn't anything in the teaching of Jesus that suggests that we should construe our present circumstances as one of political oppression in the sort of the human realm. And on the contrary, he recognizes there is persecution, that there is conflict at that level, but he never suggests the military as a way to resolve that conflict. And in fact, he is emphatic that his kingdom is not of this world. However, he does portray his ministry as one of open conflict with those cosmic powers, the devils. So was Daniel saw sort of the military and the spiritual as aligned in working on earth, Jesus seems to locate the battle just in the cosmic realm. And so he shows up in the synagogue in Capernaum, for example, Mark chapter 3. And first thing that happens, he starts to teach, and the demons cry out, "We know who you are. You're the Holy One of God. Have you come to destroy us?" In the parables, Jesus talks about the role the devil plays in the mind. He'll say, well, the Satan will come and steal away the word that is sown in your heart. Tellingly, when Peter opposes the message of the crucifixion, Jesus' response is, "Get thee behind me, Satan."
Mm-hmm.
And it's as if, and of course, in Luke's gospel, when he's nailed to the cross, he turns and prays and says, "Forgive them, Father, for they know not what they're doing." In the sense, and Satan is the strong man who has to be bound so that Jesus can plunder his house. And so the sense that you get is that in the mind of Christ, these human enemies that we're to love and forgive and embrace are in thrall to a foreign power, to a cosmic force that they themselves do not understand. And it kind of opens up a space for the Christian to show mercy and kindness to those that persecute them, recognizing that they're not in every respect the masters of their own actions.
Mm.
And so the book of Ephesians develops the theme even more. Ephesians, I think it's chapter 6, where we read that our battle is not against flesh and blood, but against the powers and principalities in the heavenly realms. And so by relocating the scene of conflict to the cosmic realm, to the demonic realm, it actually facilitates the love of one's neighbor. And when Christ overcomes the demonic powers, and thinking of the Gerasene demoniac, we're told that the demoniac is restored to his right mind. And so one of the fruits of the gospel, one of the fruits of redemption, is a sound mind.
Mm.
In monastic theology, Evagrius Ponticus, for example, develops a kind of cognitive therapy for attaining peace of mind, conquest over the passions, sort of healthy psychological life, that he conceives of as a battle with the demonic forces for control of one's thoughts. Thomas Aquinas will develop a whole ethic around the obedience to right reason and the dignity of the human mind, leading to things like the principles of human rights and dignity that we find in the UN Declaration, for example. And so there's a kind of profoundly humanizing element and a rationalizing element to Jesus' teaching about the demonic, which might strike modern people as kind of ironic, that would typically think of that as a sort of superstitious, backward way of looking at reality. My contention is that, in fact, freed people up to have greater love for neighbor and greater patience with them in their wrongdoing. The French have a saying, "Tout comprendre, c'est tout pardonner." If you understand everything about somebody, you can forgive them everything. And by seeing the conflict in this way, a battle against principalities and powers rather than flesh and blood, then one has actually opened up a space in one's heart to be more forgiving, more loving towards one's neighbor. So what then do you do in your attitude towards those cosmic powers? Well, it's entirely appropriate to want justice. And that's another aspect of the gospel. You know, the psalmist would pray in Psalm chapter 3, "Break the teeth of the wicked, O Lord, strike all my enemies on the jaw." That's Psalm 3, verse 7. But we don't pray that for our human enemies. But we can will that for the fall of the fallen angels who have only hate and malice behind them. Now, in one respect only, I think we could talk about appreciating or loving them, not in the brokenness of their will, but in the integrity of their nature, insofar as it is intact. Because all being, anything that has concrete existence, exists by the will of God, and God wills only that which is good. So it's not the existence of the fallen angels that's evil, it's rather the deformation of their will.
Mm.
And so in that sense, we can even say about them, hate the sinner, hate the sin, not the sinner as such. Now, we want justice on them. We want them to receive recompense for their evil actions. We don't approve in any way what they do. But we don't curse God for having made them, because God only makes that which is good.
Okay. And Dean, thanks so much for your call. That opens up a line for you right now at 833-288-EWTN. If you have a question for Dr. David Anders, 833-288-3986. Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders here on EWTN. Let's go now to Ron in Dubuque, Iowa, listening on Aquinas Communications. Hello, Ron. What's on your mind today, sir?
Yes, I was wondering. I was listening to a televangelist. He's on every day. And he said that the sacrament of communion, the Eucharist, and baptism are not sacraments. Where do they get that from?
Yeah, thank you. I really appreciate the question. So it's important to understand what is meant by the concept of a sacrament in Catholic theology. In Catholic theology, sacraments are signs, they are symbols. But they're signs and symbols that are accompanied by a divine promise. And the promise is that wherever the sign is present, so will the reality also be present.
Mm.
And so baptism, for example, signifies, it symbolizes purification from sin. But we have this promise that when we perform the sign, purification from sin necessarily accompanies it. You always get the thing being signified.
Sure.
And same thing with Holy Communion, that when we, the body and blood of Christ are signified by their identity with bread and wine, there is a sign there, and they also signified in a state of separation, bread over here, body over there. I mean, bread here, wine there, body here, blood there, signifying Jesus' death.
Mm-hmm.
But in addition to being a sign, we also get the real thing. So we get the real presence of Christ, body, blood, soul, and divinity in Holy Communion. It's signified, and it also delivers what it signifies. That's really the essence of what the Church means by a sacrament. Now, when televangelists reject the idea that they are sacraments, typically what they're rejecting, they don't reject the sign aspect. Catholics confess that they are signs and symbols.
Mm-hmm.
Protestants typically agree, yes, they're signs and symbols. Where some Protestants differ is in saying, they're just signs and symbols. The Catholic would say they're signs and symbols, and they bring the thing signified.
Mm.
The Protestant typically says they're only signs and symbols. They don't come with the thing signified. They have no supernatural power. Now, where do Protestants get that idea from? Well, clearly not from the Bible. One place they don't get that idea from is from the Bible. Where they do get it from is Protestant tradition.
Ah.
That's where they get it from. And the origin of that belief really comes not in Luther, who believed very much in the reality of the sacraments, but from the Reformed tradition. That's the Protestants that grew up in Switzerland in the 1520s around Zurich, the city of Zurich, and a man named Ulrich Zwingli. There's another great Reformed, great in the sense of important, Reformed theologian named John Calvin. Calvin did believe in the efficacy of the sacraments, but he had a kind of novel interpretation that tended over time to push people more back towards that Zwinglian side of things, towards that merely symbolic. Now, the reasons Zwingli took the positions that he did are idiosyncratic to him, and I'll probably go into those another time.
All right, very good. And Ron, thank you so much for your call. Appreciate hearing from you in Dubuque today. It's Called to Communion here on EWTN. In a moment, we're going to be talking with Michael, a first-time caller from Troy, Michigan, also Amon in Atlanta, and we've got a couple lines open for you as well at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. If you're listening to us on TV today, you'll want to send us an email for that. And the address is ctc@ewtn.com, ctc@ewtn.com. By the way, you can always text us. Text the letters EWTN to 58177. Wait for our response and then text us your first name and your brief question. Back in a moment with lots more Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders here on EWTN. Do stay with us. It's Called to Communion with Dr. David Anders here on EWTN. Our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. If you have a question for David Or perhaps you'd like to explain what is stopping you from becoming a Catholic. Ooh. 833-288-3986. Hey, our friends in Kansas need to hear from you next week. Divine Mercy Radio will be airing their spring pledge drive that is Tuesday through Friday. So if you're listening in Hayes or Great Bend or Colby or anywhere, please support your EWTN Catholic radio station. All right, as promised, here is Michael now, a first-time caller from Troy, Michigan, listening on the great Ave Maria Radio. Hello there, Michael. What's on your mind today, sir?
Thank you for taking my call. I've always been bothered by why did God lie to Abraham saying he wanted to kill his only son? And related to that, why would a moral believer in God obey that order?
Yeah, thanks. I really appreciate the question. So this is a thorny one, and I'm not gonna lie to you. I find it challenging myself. And here are some considerations I think we have to take. One is that in Catholic theology, we always read the Old Testament in consideration of the New. We read the Old Testament as it points us to Christ. And so Jesus becomes the paradigm for interpreting all stories in the Old Testament. One of the things that's entailed by that is the Catholic belief that the Bible contains multiple layers of meaning, the senses of Scripture, four of them, in fact. And we can distinguish a literal sense, which does not mean the literalistic sense of the fundamentalist. We'll get to that in a minute. A moral sense, what's called an anagogical sense, which is what evokes the hope of eternal life and personal transformation. And then the allegorical sense, which is the one that points us ultimately to Jesus. And the three collapse into one called the spiritual sense. So you've got the literal and the spiritual. And far and away, the most important is the spiritual. And one early Christian writer, Origen of Alexandria, who wrote in the 3rd century, went so far as to say, you should cast away the literal sense as the bitter rind of a nut.
Oh, my.
And we see that. That may shock you when you hear it at first until you realize that Jesus our Lord did that. There are places in the Gospels where Jesus himself resists quite strongly what would seem to be the surface meaning of a text. Now, this is a different context, but I want to illustrate the principle for you. Matthew chapter 19, the Pharisees ask Jesus if it's right for a man to divorce his wife for any reason. What prompted the question? Well, what prompted the question was the law of Moses gives instructions for divorcing your wife. It says, when you divorce your wife, write her a certificate of divorce, period. It doesn't really deal with whether there's a just cause or not. It just says you divorce your wife and you send her packing. And so in rabbinical commentary, there was a debate about whether or not a man could divorce his wife for any reason or if it had to be for cause. And one school of thought said it could be for any reason, and one school of thought said it could only be for cause. And so they went to Jesus for his opinion on the matter. And Christ surprises everybody by saying, well, you can't divorce your wife. And they're kind of dumbfounded because that's not what they were expecting. And they thought he'd answer within the literal text of the law.
Uh-huh.
And they said, well, then why does Moses let you do this? And he says, well, Moses said this because of the hardness of your heart. In other words, it was a kind of condescension to human weakness.
Mm-hmm.
But God never intended this from the beginning. What God joined together, man can't separate. The funny thing is Deuteronomy doesn't say anything to suggest that interpretation. So this is Christ's interpolation, right? This is Christ reading this into the text from his a higher ethic of love and the honor of God that really relativized the text of the Old Testament. We find St. Paul doing the same thing in stories from the lives of the patriarchs, and he explicitly teaches these are allegories that point us to the reality of Jesus. And I could give you many other instances, both in the New Testament and from the Fathers. Peter tells us that the flood of Noah is actually an allegory or a type for Christian baptism, and on and on and on and on and on. And at times, Catholic interpreters, even in classical antiquity, would strongly resist the literal meaning of a text. So, for example, Gregory of Nyssa, in his commentary on the life of Moses, resists strongly the conclusion that God literally told the angel of death to kill the innocent firstborn of Egypt. He says that would seem to implicate God in injustice, so we have to read this spiritually instead as an instruction to cut off the first roots of vice. Now, you might find that reading implausible. It's beyond the point. It's beyond the question right now. All I'm illustrating is that there's a consistent Christian way of reading the Old Testament that doesn't just start at the literal level. And so the way a Catholic interpreter begins with the story of Abraham is, let's start with the spiritual sense. And the one that's most evident, of course, is the allegorical, that the sacrifice of Isaac is a type of the sacrifice of Christ. Now, Thomas Aquinas' view was that when God brought about a historical event in the life of the people of the Old Covenant, he did so with a view to that being typological, that it would point to some reality in the work of redemption in Jesus. It's quite evident that the idea that we don't have to sacrifice our sons because God sacrificed his very own son in Jesus, that's what's in view in the sacrifice of Abraham. And that's the sort of the classic Catholic take on this position. Now, if you ask what's the literal sense of the text, now here again, literal doesn't mean the way the fundamentalist reads it. The fundamentalist thinks that the literal sense of the text is like the narrow denotative sense of the words. But the Catholic thinks the literal means what is in the mind of the sacred writer within his historical context. What's going on here? And one of the things you find throughout the book of Genesis is that there's a kind of contrast, a narrative contrast that's set up quite deliberately between the worship of Yahweh, the Lord God of Israel, and that of the pagan deities, particularly of the Babylonian deities and Canaanite deities. And as human sacrifice was something practiced in ancient Canaan and among the Philistines, and you can find it North Africa, the Punic, I can't think of the word, Carthage. The Carthaginians practiced in Carthage and in Carthage and so forth. The text is sort of tempting us to ask the question, is that the kind of God the Lord is? You know, and Abraham is coming out of what would be ultimately Babylon. And so he is oriented in the world to think of right worship in terms of this kind of abominable sacrifice. And so the text at the literal level sort of raises that question, is that the sort of God that God is? And what the sacred writer seems to want to indicate in his own context is absolutely not. Whereas the pagan deity is like all about, yep, let's have that blood of your child. God actually forbids that in the Old Covenant, says you're not to do this. And it's like, tease, gotcha, that's not how I am. And the whole thing, of course, allegorically points us to the person of Jesus. So you shouldn't walk away from this with the idea that, you know, God is somehow a tyrant who demands the death of one's children. And in fact, I think the conscientious answer from the point of view of Catholic moral theology today, in light of the wisdom of Christ, is if you ever hear a voice telling you to sacrifice your child, it's not God.
Ah, very good. Michael, thanks so much for your call. We hope that's helpful for you. Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders here on EWTN. Let's go now to Aman in Atlanta, watching us on YouTube. Hey there, Aman. What's on your mind today, sir?
I am so excited to speak to Dr. David Anders about this. So I am a 32-year-old man, and one of my crosses in life is that I have a very difficult time forming relationships. I'm a new Catholic, and so I'm trying to see if I can bring my bring Catholic theology into this. I really need help understanding what Catholics teach about the nature of friendships and what I can learn.
Okay, thanks you. I really appreciate the question. So, friendship is a natural human good. Humans are sociable by nature, and having healthy relationships is actually part of the virtue of justice. And so Thomas Aquinas writes in his commentary on the virtue of justice that there's a subset of justice that he calls affability, or friendliness, which is not the same thing as having friends, that he considers necessary. Right? I mean, it's not the height of justice, but if you can't show common courtesy to your neighbor, how are you going to really do justice to him? You know, so you've got to start with common courtesy. That's kind of the first step in developing the virtue of justice. And you know, when it comes to just the pragmatics of making friends and relationships, one piece of perennial wisdom is listen more than you than you talk and ask more questions than you answer. And everybody likes to hear themselves speak, and that's true of your neighbor as well. And so sort of part one of the virtue of friendliness is, you know, learn how to be open and accompanying to other people and hear what they have to say and draw them out and make them believe that you're interested in them and make yourself interested in them, you know, what they have to say. You know, my dad was kind of a funny character. He had a rather flat personality and kind of low affect. One thing I always appreciated about him, however, was that he had a tremendous capacity to ask other people about themselves and actually sit and listen to what they said in response.
Wow.
And that served him well in life. You know, he wasn't a great joke teller and, you know, not a great raconteur necessarily, but he had a capacity to ask people open-ended questions about themselves and what they were into and really care about what they had to say. And that goes a long way towards building goodwill with people, you know.
Sure.
I'd also add that you shouldn't beat yourself up for loneliness, because as I'm sure you're aware, the developed world is suffering a kind of epic plague of loneliness, and this is a social, economic, technological, demographic development. And so the problem of not having friends, it may not be your problem uniquely or one about your personality. This is people your age and younger, this is a perennial difficulty in civilization. I mean, a number of years ago, I accompanied a young person to a interview for a trade school, and I wasn't being interviewed. I was just sort of sitting in the background, and I was kind of shocked at how shallow the interview was. And we got done, and the woman conducting the interview said, "Well, now that you're finished, I just kind of tell you what the point of this was. The whole point of calling you in was to see if you could be in another room with someone for 30 minutes and not be on your phone." You know, and that's really destroying our capacity for friendship.
It is.
So, you know, one benefit of the Catholic faith. Look, Catholics are bad about being on their phone, as bad as anybody else, but at least we have a theology of worship that it should detach us from those things for at least some period of time during the week, and a recognition that there's a human good there to be developed. So, you know, try to put yourself in the company of like-minded Catholics and ask open-ended questions and be present and accompany, and particularly to people that are downtrodden experiencing sorrows. And people always like a sympathetic ear. And even if you're not the life of the party, you can learn to be kind, and that goes an awful long way. And if it doesn't develop naturally in short order, it may not be entirely your fault. It may be the fault of a generation that you inhabit that is unfortunately handicapped and deformed in this essential social skill.
All around us, we see human silos, don't we?
Human silos, yeah.
Aman, thank you so much for your call. Glad you're checking in from Atlanta. Call to Communion here on EWTN. This weekend, be sure to join us for Women Made New, Saturday at noon Eastern on EWTN Radio. It's real talk from Kristalina Everett and her guests, all about Catholic marriage and family in the 21st century. And by the way, Kristalina's book, Women Made New, Reflections on Adversity, Transformation, and Healing, that book is now available at EWTNRC.com, EWTNRC.com. You may want to check that out. Let's go to Joe now in Oregon, listening on the Great Modern Day Radio. Hey there, Joe. What's on your mind today, sir?
Well, I've got a question that'll probably take us into canon law.
Okay.
Because of medical circumstances, my wife and I have been told to be cautious and be protective of each other, which I don't know how the canon laws state all of the about the traditional or non-traditional uses of medical care.
And, yeah, Joe, if I can jump in here, what our screener's notes reflect is that your wife has a horrible cancer of some sort, and because of her treatment, you've been instructed to wear a condom. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. All right. I look, first of all, I'm really sorry for your situation, and our heart goes out to you, particularly to your wife, and her terrible cancer, and she'll be in our prayers. And really, you have our deepest condolences in this. I don't know enough about your situation to know what the possible rationale would be, what having cancer would have to do with contracepting and marital intercourse. If the purpose is to prevent her from getting pregnant because in her condition she couldn't carry a child, or the child itself would be in grave danger, to chemotherapy drugs, that sort of thing. If the purpose of the contraception is so that she's not carrying a child, that's not licit in Catholic theology and Catholic moral theology. And there are other effective ways of preventing pregnancy, and the most effective one of all is abstinence. And that is a perfectly legitimate decision to make. If a woman is sick and she's, terribly ill and taking dangerous medications, and there's just absolute no way she could get pregnant without causing grave danger to herself or the child, then deciding for a time to be abstinent would be a very morally defensible position to take, and probably the prudent one. Short of that, natural family planning is extremely effective. It's 99% effective when done properly. It is not, if you can't tolerate that 1%, then abstinence is the proper procedure. If there's some other reason in view that is beyond the scope of this call and my expertise, my recommendation is that is something for you to take up in the private context of the confessional with a priest who knows all of the details of your intimate situation and is really beyond the scope of this show.
Okay. Joe, you and your wife will both be in our prayers. Thank you so much for your call. Let's go to Adam, a first-time caller from Missouri. Adam, what's on your mind today, sir?
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question regarding free will. If God knew everything before he created it, and then went ahead and created it that way, the way that he knew, how do we have free will? Like, if God knows we will do something, can we choose not to? Like, for example, if God knows what I will choose to watch on television tonight, could I choose something else? Won't I always just choose what he knows I will choose based on the way he created me? Like, I was an electrician, and if I design a control system for a machine, it will behave a certain way. And wouldn't it kind of be the same with God and us, only be infinitely simpler and more perfectly knowable for God? Thanks.
Yeah, I understand the question. I really appreciate it. So I've got a number of things to say. The first one is that foreknowledge does not necessarily constrain freedom. And we have instances of this all over the place in human experience. So, for example, I have a son who really, really, really doesn't like any kind of fermented food at all. Cheese at the top of the list, just will not eat cheese.
Really?
And and so if he's at school and the cafeteria serves lasagna, he is going to go hungry that day. I mean, he's just absolutely going to go hungry. He's not going to peel the cheese off. He's not going to, try to nibble on the... He is going hungry. I know with near infallible certitude that if I offered him a baked brie for dinner, he ain't going to eat it. Now, my foreknowledge of his future action in no way constrains his action, right? So not all foreknowledge, clearly, foreknowledge is absolutely consistent with human freedom. Now, you raise another question, which is not about foreknowledge, it's about nature. And that is, if I choose in accord with my nature, with my temperament, with my habits, my cultural upbringing, all of these forces that come into play to make me the distinct kind of person that I am, can I really have free will? And this is irrespective of whether or not there's a God who foreknows the future. Now, there are many people who hold that you cannot have free will on that basis. And I think most prominently in the modern world would be the public figure Sam Harris, the atheist Sam Harris, who's kind of notorious for denying that there's such a thing as free will, specifically for this reason, that when we choose, we're choosing on the basis of temperament that is, either genetically or behaviorally conditioned, but we can't do anything about the temperament that underlies our choices. I mean, like, there are certain styles of music that try as I might, I can't like. You know, I like most of them, but I can't bring myself to like them, you know. And does that mean I don't have freedom? Well, now here, it depends on your definition of freedom. Because there are some people who maintain that in order to have morally relevant free will, you have to have what's called libertarian free will, perfectly indeterministic free will. That is to say, no reason can be assigned for the will willing as it wills. It just wills. That's just what a will does.
Okay.
You know? Kind of like, you know, subatomic particles in quantum physics that just sort of pop into existence at seemingly at random with no predictability at all. And that's the way the will has to will in order for it to be free. Some people, not everybody, believe that that was the Catholic philosopher John Duns Scotus's view of human freedom. Some people disagree about that, but others think that that was the way Scotus construed freedom. Another Catholic theologian who said, nope, that's just not what freedom means, would be Thomas Aquinas. And Thomas Aquinas thought, no, all you need to have in order to have morally relevant freedom is the capacity to rationally deliberate. So the ability to conceptualize a thing as a good, to conceptualize more than one thing as a good simultaneously, and then to rationally deliberate between those perceived goods, that provided you had that capacity, you had freedom in the morally relevant sense.
Mm.
And that kind of leaves wide open the possibility that things like habit and temperament and genetics can influence that deliberation. In fact, Thomas himself recognized that, say, in deliberating about the contents of the natural law, that someone could be blinded by their own culture in such a way that they became incapable of seeing some element of the law. Like he says there were people from a Germanic background, for example, in his time that had a hard time conceptualizing theft as wrong, for example, you know. And I was talking to somebody last night, actually, who has a relative that is in missionary work in a part of the world that I will not mention, where theft is lionized, for example.
Really?
Yeah. But Thomas says that doesn't affect the nature of freedom as morally relevant, you know, in his philosophical system.
Mm-hmm.
The Protestant theologian, the Puritan theologian, Jonathan Edwards, wrote an extended treatise on the freedom of the will. And when you read his treatise, you walk away going, well, sounds like Edwards doesn't believe in free will, because he really leans into this idea of choices being determined by temperament. But again, for his purposes, the will was sufficiently free under that relevant definition to have moral relevance. And so a lot depends on how you define freedom. And I typically tend to side with Thomas, that as long as you can rationally deliberate, and that is something of which I think all of us have immediate intuitive knowledge. Like, I'm just conscious of being able to rationally deliberate. And sometimes I'm presented with the temptation to do something wrong. Sometimes I do things wrong. But when I do, I'm usually conscious of the fact that, yeah, this is wrong. And I'm doing it anyway.
Yeah.
Right? As long as you have that rational awareness, you have sufficient freedom in the church's understanding for it to be morally relevant.
Adam, thanks so much for your call today. Marcus is watching us on YouTube today, and Marcus says, Dr. Anders, I believe most of the saints of the ages who went to Holy Mass would not follow or understand the post-Vatican II Mass. What say you?
Okay, so I think that a great many of the saints who lived before the Council of Trent
mm-hmm.
would not understand or follow the Mass as it was defined by the Council of Trent, right? I mean, I'm thinking in particular of the entire Eastern wing of the Church that would have celebrated the liturgy according to St. John Chrysostom, for example. Different theology of the liturgy, different spirituality,
uh-huh.
you know, very different experience of the liturgy, or the liturgy of St. James and the Syriac tradition. And so it's always been the case that there has never been one normative form of the liturgy for the Catholic Church. There's always been different liturgies within the Catholic Church. More interesting, let's take the Latin Mass as it's traditionally understood and ask the question, have most people who attended the Latin Mass before Vatican II understood the Latin Mass?
Mm.
And there is a tremendous amount of evidence, good documentary evidence, from the 14th and 15th centuries, that lay theologies of the Mass differed significantly from clerical understanding.
Wow.
And one of the motives of the Council of Trent and of the Protestant reformers was to standardize Catholic liturgy and to teach a normative understanding, because there was so much diversity of expression within lay devotional practice. So whether or not your thesis is true, I think it is of little relevance to, say, the current liturgy wars.
Okay. Marcus, thanks for watching us on YouTube. Also watching today is Katie, watching on YouTube. Couldn't get to Katie's question. We're going to carry that over until our next program. Hey, Dr. David Andrews, thank you.
Thank you, Tom.
We do this program Monday through Friday on EWTN Radio at 2 p.m. Eastern. Do check out our next podcast at EWTN.com/radio. On behalf of our great team, I'm Tom Price. See you next time. God bless.